Illustrated. My name is Bill, volunteer reader here at Sun Sounds of Arizona. He loves his job and is historically good at it, so why doesn't LA love Dave Roberts back? And this feature is written by Sports Illustrated writer Stephanie Epstein. In the ensuing months, the details have blurred. As the Dodgers recorded the final out, their manager remembers throwing up his arms and sprinting towards the field. He might have cried. He probably shouted. He definitely beamed. You might have thought that Dave Roberts had just won the World Series. When he actually did, 2 weeks later, his second World Series in 5 years, his reaction was similar. By then, he had put the finishing touches on a masterful postseason and all but pose for his plaque at Cooperstown. But in order to do all that, Los Angeles had to win the National League Division Series 3-2 over the Padres, and when they did, Roberts felt relief, not just that his team would keep playing, but that he would be there while they did. On a warm day in January, Roberts, age 52, leans forward in the dining room of his sprawling San Diego home and addresses the fear that he tried not to let consume him that week. The Dodgers had won 2 pennants and a World Series since he arrived in Los Angeles before the 2016 season. But dating to a 2022 NLDS defeat to the Padres after winning 111 regular season games, they had lost 6 straight postseason games, all to less talented division rivals, all in games that Roberts later admitted the opponents had just wanted more. Now they had spent $1.2 billion in a single offseason to assemble perhaps the greatest collection of talent ever to jog onto a baseball field, and they were on the verge of crashing out of the division series yet again. Quote, "I did feel that, right or wrong, truth or not truth, I don't know that answer. But I felt my job was on the line if we didn't win that series," Robert says. "That's just my truth." Unquote. He largely kept his worries to himself. Even bench coach Danny Lehman says that he did not know. Chris Woodward, then a senior advisor and now the team's first base coach, had an idea, he says, mostly because he himself lost a managerial job when the Rangers moved on from him in the year 2022 after 3.5 years in charge. "I knew," Woodward says. "I know what he feels like." But Roberts never said anything aloud. Looking back on 2024, he says that he feels good about the way that he handled the most challenging season of his career. Nearly unprecedented expectations coupled with nearly unprecedented injuries. 27 Dodgers combined to spend 2,361 days on the injured list, 38% more than the league average and 19% more than the team with the next highest total, the Boston Red Sox. In September alone, Los Angeles was without 8 different starting pitchers. In the middle of that month, Roberts called a rare team meeting and delivered a fiery speech, one that players still point to as the moment that things turned. All that roster churn left him navigating 4 planned bullpen games in the playoffs. And he kept his focus on the team, not on his job security. Quote, "I am proud of the fact that I didn't let that angst affect how I managed and let the players feel that," unquote, Roberts says. He has had plenty of practice trying to ignore criticism. He still flashes back occasionally to 2 times that he heard boos from home fans in the World Series. In 2018, when he removed Rich Hill with 1 out in the 7th inning of Game 4, up 4-0. And in the year 2020, when he pulled Clayton Kershaw with 2 outs in the 6th inning of Game 5, up 4-2. The Dodgers blew the lead to the Red Sox in 2018, but held it in 2020 against the Rays. In both cases, Robert says, fans were operating with incomplete information. He was actually just going to deliver Hill a pep talk, but the starter misunderstood and handed his manager the ball, no longer in the right frame of mind to pitch. Kershaw and Roberts had agreed before the start of the inning that the pitcher would face only 2 more batters. Roberts' explanations have not quieted the gripes on social media and sports talk radio. Neither did the 2020 title, LA's first in 32 years. At times, it has been fair to wonder if his detractors include members of his own front office. Roberts did not merit a spot on the podium of Shohei Ohtani's introductory press conference last offseason. He was also not listed in Ohtani's contract as a quote-unquote key man. If either owner Mark Walter or president of baseball operations Andrew Friedman departs, the deal would be voided. And Roberts opened spring training as a lame duck with 1 year remaining on his contract. Roberts hopes that the 2024 title will change everything. Over and over, his players use the word vindication to describe what they felt on his behalf when they raised the trophy. His career 627 winning percentage is the best ever among those who have managed at least 1,000 games. His teams have won 100 games in 5 of his 8 full seasons, and never fewer than 91. And he has now won more World Series titles than 9 of the 23 skippers in the Hall of Fame. "I really wanted this one in the worst way," Robert says. "I think when I look back, I didn't appreciate how much I wanted to shut the haters up, I guess," unquote. It may take him even longer to appreciate that he didn't shut them up at all. Early in Roberts' managerial career, he developed a reputation as a bit of a phony, in part because he always appears to be having fun in a job that does not always seem to be very much fun. He answers questions about decisions that he did not make. He takes the blame for organizational processes. He drags himself out there every day and lets people scream at him. By the Dodgers Media Relations Department count, Roberts addressed the press 537 times in 2024. And yet Roberts tries to shake hands with every player every day. He remembers reporters' names and thanks them for their time. When the national anthem plays, he whispers to his coaches, "This is the best part of the day," unquote. Eventually, the people around Roberts came to understand that his optimism is self-fulfilling. "It's nuts," he acknowledges, "but I believe that we have the best culture and players want to play for me," unquote. Entering his 10th year in Los Angeles, Roberts has gained confidence in his voice. In that fateful meeting last fall, he called upon the players to stop feeling sorry for themselves after yet another injury hit the club. He reminded them of the three former MVPs, right fielder Mookie Betts, first baseman Freddie Freeman, and two-way star Shohei Ohtani, and nine All-Stars still on the roster. "We are still the Dodgers," he told them. "We still have a lot of great players," unquote. He challenged them to act like it. They went 11 wins, 3 losses to close the regular season, and then 11 wins, 5 losses in October. At times, Roberts has become less gentle in the way that he delivers information, which his players appreciate. No team offers less playing time for more talent than the Dodgers, which means no manager has more hard conversations than Roberts. At first, he tried to soften the blow. "He's a very likable guy, and sometimes when you have a tough conversation, people can stop liking you, and maybe he didn't want to affect relationships early on," says utility man Kiki Hernandez. "He got to the point where he realized that we are all grown men," unquote. Now Roberts just tells them the plan. "We're the Dodgers," says Woodward. "We consider ourselves the best organization in baseball. To play on this team, you need to be one of the best, if not the best, or you do your part," unquote. Often that means sitting based on platoon matchups. "Roberts is upfront with me about it, and I know what the situation is," says third baseman Max Muncy, who has started only 55% of the games against lefties since his 2018 call-up. Quote, "It doesn't mean I have to like it, but I understand it. And because he's not beating around the bush, it is easier to take," unquote. It helps that the players know that he cares about them as people. In May, when reliever Johan Ramirez hit 2 straight Cincinnati Reds players, Roberts trotted to the mound not to give him the hook, but to give him a hug. The afternoon of righty Ben Kasparius's debut, the pitcher admitted that he had idolized Roberts as a childhood Red Sox fan. 2 months later, Roberts referenced the conversation with Kasparius's father, Phil. And Freddie Freeman chokes up as he calls Roberts, quote, "more than a manager," unquote. When Freeman's son, Max, then age 3, battled a neurological disorder last season, he says that Roberts seemed to know implicitly when to reach out and when to give him space. Freeman adds, quote, "There's a reason why so many people will play injured and hurt for him and his organization. He is the leader of this team, and there's a reason that show that is shortstop Miguel Rojas and I, all of us who were hanging on by a thread last year, will do anything for that man," unquote. Muncy says, quote, "There should never be anybody that's wearing a number 30 Dodgers jersey ever again. I never want to play for another manager," unquote. The way that Roberts describes his role, it is hard to imagine why anyone else would want the job. Quote, "The manager is essentially the CEO," he says. "You've got global domestic sponsorships, corporate sponsors, you've got owners, you've got TV, you've got media, you've got fans. Then you've got the baseball side, right? And so you're dealing with all of this, and you have to understand that everything you do or say is a reflection of this huge engine, and that's a big undertaking. And it's something that I really value. I feel a big responsibility, and I love it, but I always have to keep that front of mind, unquote. That's all even more true now that the Dodgers have all but captured the Japanese market after signing Ohtani and righties Yoshinobu Yamamoto and Roki Sasaki in the last two off-seasons. The World Series had better TV ratings in Japan than in the U.S. Almost no one else in baseball can relate to the scrutiny that Roberts faces. Quote, Aaron Boone is the only person, Roberts says of the Yankees manager. There's other high payroll teams that I don't need to name that go up and down. The Yankees have to win. And when Aaron wins 100 games and they don't win the World Series, his job is being called for in the same way, unquote. Boone attended USC. Roberts attended UCLA. They played against each other in the majors. They share a handful of close local friends. Both carved out good playing careers for themselves, but are remembered mostly for one spectacular playoff moment. Boone's walk-off homer against Boston in the 2003 ALCS and Roberts' steal of second in Game 4 of the 2004 ALCS against the Yankees. Now they helm the two most historic franchises in the sport. They have compared notes over dinners in ballpark hallways while walking 18 holes. In a lot of ways, Boone says, we're looking in the mirror at each other, unquote. And both have come to understand that they are not entirely in control of their legacies. So much of the narrative is an outcome-based one, says Freddie Freeman. If someone would have gotten a big hit, then Roberts would have managed great. There's just so much more nuance in it than I think is factored into the public narrative. And so I feel that he's unfairly worn a lot of the different things that have happened in different Octobers, unquote. If the manager is the CEO, then any fan who's ever donned a Dodgers cap is on the board of directors. It's a beautiful day at Camelback Ranch in Arizona, and the hundreds of fans lining the pathways trodden by their heroes are delighted when Roberts speeds by in his golf cart headed for the backfields. Dave, they scream, along with a cacophony of encouragement. He slows down and beams. He is wise to enjoy the adulation while it lasts. It will fade the minute that he pulls a cruising starter or uses a lineup fans dislike. I hate even talking about the haters because you're giving them too much power, Roberts says. But you feel it, and you hear it, and you do the best you can. But people are always going to have their opinions, right? There's people that still feel that I shouldn't manage this club, unquote. He has given some thought to why. Some people believe that he is too wedded to the numbers, he says. I can make a decision 100% on my eyes and my gut. And there are people that say, what are you doing making an analytical decision, he says. That narrative, it just hasn't stopped, unquote. But he fears that the disconnect runs deeper. It's not just that fans don't connect with his choices. They often don't connect with him personally. I'm certainly very stoic in my job, he says. I want it to reflect a $6 or $7 billion machine in the Dodgers, and I'm trying to represent the brand in a way that is very classic. I can't be Tommy Lasorda. I don't want to be Tommy Lasorda in the sense that you're going up and down, riding the wave, because I feel that the consistency of my demeanor means a lot. Fans want me to freak out with them, unquote. He laughs. I am freaking out, he says, but I'm freaking out inside. They want me to curse and get thrown out 10 times and get on social media and call out the players. Roberts continues, I think that if you are ownership, if you're Andrew Friedman, and you see a manager who is moving with the weather like a flag in the wind, you cannot depend on him. And so my job is to be a stalwart in the organization. And so as we've gone through ups and downs in a season, I think it's very important to be consistent, and that's what I try to do. And fans just don't like that, unquote. Their opinion is not likely to change just because Roberts managed the 2024 postseason beautifully. It certainly didn't after he did so in 2020. That came as a surprise to him. Quote, I did think it was going to change after we won the World Series, he says. But the Dodgers went 13 wins, 2 losses to open the 2021 season. 2 weeks later, the Los Angeles Times printed 4 letters to the editor calling for his head. And outside Los Angeles, he realized that people discounted that 2020 title because it came in the COVID-shortened 60-game season. I would still to my grave say that it was harder, he says, but it grated on him that so many fans disagreed. Between that and the fact that the city was still locked down in the aftermath and never celebrated fully, that championship did not quite bring him the approval that he sought. But he has it now. The criticism has annoyed him, but it has also motivated him. So what will he use now? He does not pause to think. He tried to repurpose the asterisk that some fans assigned to the 2020 title by encouraging his players to focus on earning a parade, which LA did not mind amid COVID. That's the way I spun that narrative, he says. Going forward, I think that the dynasty, the legacy, is going to have to be our mantra. We're trying to do something that no one has done since the mid-1990s, unquote. Sure, but even that is an organizational answer. What about for Dave Roberts? Now he does take a breath, quote, My job is essentially to try to protect them from any outside noise or pressure and let them focus on their job, he says. Trying to validate or prove people wrong is just adding to pressure, so just kind of letting our guys just focus on the job at hand is important, unquote. Besides, after 2 championships in 5 years, it's just it's not going to bother me, he says with a smile. The trick will not be proving people wrong. It will be accepting that he has proven them wrong, and it doesn't matter. Now, you may think that you too could manage a roster of that talent to a championship, but could you shuffle through 40 different pitchers over 6 months, second only to the Miami Marlins, who lost 100 games? Could you find the intestinal fortitude to collaborate with your staff to punt a World Series game to give yourself a more favorable matchup in the next one, knowing that if your bet fails, you alone will face the criticism? Could you do it all while your every grimace is dissected in 3 languages, while you navigate 26 egos, while you wonder where you will live next year? I love it, Robert says. I freaking love baseball. I love coaching players. I love the Dodgers, unquote. Friedman bristles at the question of whether it was fair for Roberts to worry about his job in October. Is it fair for him to feel that way, Friedman says? I don't know. Ask him. You can't ask me if it's fair for him to feel a certain way. Were we going to fire him? No, it wasn't even a consideration. That's all I can answer. And he adds, I feel like one competitive advantage that we've had is our organizational continuity. We make mistakes, but it allows us to learn from them and grow from them, unquote. Roberts has learned that he could ask nearly as much of his players as he does of himself. After Game 4 of the NLDS, Woodward told Roberts that the team was starting to resemble its leader. Quote, the grit, the grind, Woodward says. I played against him. He was a grinder at heart. He loved the game. I told him we're getting pushed a little bit, and I think this group can handle it. If this team takes on who you are, we'll get through. And we did, unquote. It was the hardest season of Robert's career. And the thing is, says Lehman, the next one's going to be harder, unquote. A dozen yards away, Roberts watches extra infield drills for a while and then strides towards the throngs of fans lining the pathway towards the facility. The crowd clamors for him, and he spends nearly 10 minutes signing autographs and smiling as they tell him how much 2024 meant to them. Eventually, he waves and heads inside to focus on 2025. The cheers recede. And again, that feature is entitled Dave Roberts, Overcoming the Dodger Blues, written by Sports Illustrated writer Stephanie Epstein. And in another feature from this month's Sports Illustrated, the headline reads, Going Down a Rocky Road. The Philadelphia Eagles embraced their inner Italian stallion en route to a title. This feature written by Connor Orr of Sports Illustrated. The Eagles won the Super Bowl because of a superior running game, along with one of the most improved defenses in the NFL. But according to some industry experts like my mother-in-law, Teresa Cuccinello, the Eagles also dominated for one important reason. They are more Italian than any other team in the NFL. No offense to Tommy DeVito and the Giants, but recent breadcrumbs supporting the theory have been impossible to ignore. On an episode of Chris Long's Green Light podcast in January, former Philadelphia defensive tackle Bo Allen related a story about how he once went to see center Jason Kelce in the staff locker room and was placated during his wait by a cannoli. Vic Fangio, already famously quoted for refusing to provide his significant other with his family meatball recipe, was asked recently about cornerback Darius Slay. Fangio compared him to a, quote, fine Dago red wine, unquote. While Dago can be considered an offensive slur towards Italian people, it is also commonly recognized as a type of fruity red wine that is coveted by older generations of Italians. After having spoken to more than a dozen coaches, players, and community members, though, there is far more to this Italian connection in Philly. According to NFL data, no team has requested more Italian flags for the league's Cultural Heritage Initiative than the Eagles, and the franchise is tied with the Patriots for the most total uniform flag patches of any country. Three of Philadelphia's staffers, head coach Nick Sirianni, newly promoted offensive coordinator Kevin Pitalo, and Dom DeSandro, the team's chief security officer, wear the Italian flag on their game day visors or pullovers. That list, however, does not include Fangio, the team's defensive coordinator, whose family arrived from Italy back in 1919 from Castiglione, a coastal town on the peninsula's northwest side. Fangio replaced Matt Patricia, another proud Italian from the Eagles' 2023 staff, who had sported the country's flag as an assistant with the Patriots a year earlier. Assistant special teams coordinator Joe Panuzio and others contribute to a vibe that redefines the word familia at the NFL level. For those outside the building, the staff serves as a cultural bridge to an area that contains one of the densest populations of Italians outside of the country itself. For those inside the building, that shared culture provides a kind of driving ethos, a deeper bond that can be drawn upon during the hardest and most isolating moments of the season. As one former Eagles coach puts it, on plenty of occasions, the Italian members of the staff have had to explain to other staffers, "We're not yelling at each other, we're just talking." What follows is the story of the Philadelphia Aquile and the people that they inspire. You're speaking to Tony. It's a Friday night, 9 days before the Eagles will compete in Super Bowl 59, and the hostess transfers the call to the back room of Aroma on 3rd, an Italian restaurant not far from the Eagles training complex. Tony Cardillo moved to this country back in 1974 and started working in the food service industry, owning and operating restaurants for all of his adult life. It wasn't long before he befriended a hard-working bricklayer, the father of a 7-year-old named Dom DeSandro. In a few minutes, the man most NFL fans know as Big Dom will swing by Aroma on his way home from work and pick up some dinner. His favorite, Tony says, is the mascarpone gnocchi with lobster, named after him, and for dessert, a hot and cold, which is an espresso chocolate bar with Italian gelato on top. In the meantime, Tony tells some stories. When he brings up the names of his favorite Eagles coaches, his orchestral command of the accent brings out sounds and notes one could not possibly conjure from a plain English reading of their last names. Tony's place is one of a handful of culinary refuges for Eagles personnel with Italian ancestry who might feel a little homesick and in the mood to be overstuffed like a grandson again. Dotted around the city, they are like little safe houses facilitated by DeSandro, where one can enter, the menu is swiftly removed from the table, and the gracious diner is fed to the point of exhaustion. It gives a big city a more condensed feel, like that of an old, familiar neighborhood. When Panuzio showed up at the door for the first time, Tony asked, "Who sent you?" "Dom," Panuzio replied. "Sit down here," Tony said. He comes back 3 minutes later and says, "I just got off the phone with Dom." Then he kisses me on both cheeks of mine, and we've been best friends ever since, says Panuzio, who now brings his family to the restaurant on Christmas and Easter. "Our culture, we're a different kind of people," says Tony. "We don't just shake hands. We hug and kiss like we're brothers and sisters. When these guys have the same culture you do, you go above and beyond in support." Unquote. If having a dimly lit secret sanctum full of delicious, freshly made delicacies was not on brand enough, consider these other lovingly stereotypical and beautifully nostalgic touches supplied by former and current Philly coaches. First, after Eagles victories this past season, apparently at the behest of Fangio, the team blasted Volari by Dean Martin on the team bus. Volari is the Italian word for fly, and was a song that multiple coaches remember being played in their houses while growing up. And Petullo wore a black and white bomber jacket, procured by DeSandro, of course, with the words "Italian Stallion" on the back when he exited the team plane upon arrival in New Orleans for the Super Bowl. Yes, it's from Rocky. Last year, Petullo wore a Rocky shirt before almost every away game underneath his warm-up suit. And coaches have gifted each other red, white, and green slipper slides, Italian horn key chains, and bottles of red wine. At least one has sported a t-shirt that says, "Wooden Spoon Survivor." And during the first few years of Sirianni's tenure, the entire staff ate takeout from Angelo's Pizzeria on 9th Street in South Philly on the day before games. The cash-only joint also has a tiny room in which the coaching staff can converge while a massive line swells outside. They take down pizza and subs stuffed with Genoa salami, hot capicola, imported ham, and mild provolone. And Big Dom, who often sports a glimmering gold necklace with an Italian pendant, has the coach's lockers stuffed full with unfathomable amount of Italian food and pastries, chicken cutlet subs, ricotta cookies, and cannolis for post-game enjoyment. Fangio still will not share his meatball recipe, though some coaches hope that the Super Bowl victory will change his mind. "Over the course of a long season," says Panuzio, "it can sometimes feel like one doesn't have a family. Love, at least from the outside, is contingent on some kind of result from a game. Bringing a piece of his culture to work chips away at the hard edges. And because of that brotherhood, there seems to be converts. I mean, everyone at this point thinks that they're Italian on our staff," Petullo says. "It's fun." Unquote. On Super Bowl Sunday, Nick LaGuardia went to the second floor of the Sons of Italy building in Hammonton, New Jersey. The upper tier, which contains a sofa and television, is lovingly nicknamed by regulars as the quote-unquote 700 level, a reference to Old Veteran Stadium, the Eagles' home for 32 seasons. Hammonton still has a massive Italian community, and LaGuardia is the past president of the fraternal Italian organization. When his beloved team hired an Italian head coach and an Italian defensive coordinator, and had DeSandro, another proud Italian, as a face of the organization, "we absolutely noticed it," LaGuardia says. "We are proud of our heritage, we are proud of our traditions, and when one of us makes good on something, we all celebrate it." Unquote. LaGuardia notes some of the stories that have been relayed about Sirianni over the years. How the coach will handwrite notes on players. How he surrounds himself with his own family and includes them into the team. how he's always been wrapping some player into a near-aggressive embrace. To LaGuardia, that's the real and tangible part of the culture seeping through. This visceral love, an Italian's unique ability to make a stranger feel as if they're part of something. They play for each other, LaGuardia says. There's a lot of stars, but they play together. It starts from Nick, unquote. Sirianni is the most successful Italian-American NFL coach since Vince Lombardi. In the 56 years since Lombardi's final game, Sirianni and so many people in his orbit were molded by the stories of mothers and fathers who came before them to a region that became a beacon for Italian immigrants. Sirianni, whose family had a clothing store in Kane, Pennsylvania, is just a few generations removed from Calabria and Sicily. Fangio's father owned a tailoring shop in Scranton. DeSandro, who grew up with Italian as his first language, says that his parents are the epitome of the American dream. In that way, the patch means something more than the music, more than the food, more than the culture. It's a realization of some long-ago dream, some seemingly hard-to-fathom grasp at progress. In the spring of 2023, Sirianni and DeSandro received an award from the National Italian American Foundation. At an event honoring them, Frank Mate, an NIAF board member, told the pair, quote, "You're not just being honored tonight for what you have accomplished in sports, but really how you have achieved your success," unquote. And again, that feature is entitled Going Down a Rocky Road. The Eagles embrace their inner Italian stallion en route to a title, written by Sports Illustrated writer Connor Orr. And from football news, let's turn now to some golf news. Next headline reads, Ben Crenshaw, golf's gentleman, feels the game's history like no other champion. The two-time Masters winner reveres golf's past and personalities, including the legendary writer who penned his 1974 Sports Illustrated cover story. And this feature is written by Sports Illustrated's Bob Herrig. Dateline, Austin, Texas. The office is packed with memorabilia from a lifetime of golf. Trophies, including two from his Masters victories, photos and clubs and ball markers and golf balls, just about anything related to the game. And there are books, lots of books, more than 400 of them, with subjects ranging from architecture and the game's various improvements to instruction, biographies, tournament programs, long-ago players, and courses. Yes, Ben Crenshaw has always been fascinated by the game's past, going back to his early competitive days. He soaked up golf history before making it himself. Among his various keepsakes is a scrapbook that includes the February 11, 1974 issue of Sports Illustrated with Crenshaw on the cover and the headline reading, "Make Way for the Kid." Crenshaw was 22 years old then. The story was penned by legendary writer Dan Jenkins, who covered golf and college football for Sports Illustrated, among other things, for many years. Crenshaw was the bright new star in the game, having won the Texas Open in his first start as a member of the PGA Tour, followed by a runner-up finish a week later. Jenkins' story was entitled, "Gentle Ben is Very Tough." All these years later, Crenshaw, now age 73, who went on to win the Masters twice as well as 19 PGA Tour titles, is sheepish about it. He remained in touch with Jenkins throughout the rest of the writer's life. Jenkins died in the year 2019. I had met him at Colonial in Fort Worth, Crenshaw says during an interview in his home. Of course, he lived in Fort Worth, and I'd run across him at the Masters. My first year was 1972. I just loved seeing him, a great Texan. He took a liking to me because of the fans that we had. He was a great friend of Daryl Royal, our University of Texas football coach here, and it was just always good to see him. He made fun of me all the time, for which I loved him. We talked about friends and football. We talked about Ben Hogan stories. Nobody loved talking more about Ben Hogan than Dan Jenkins. He was just hilarious and such a gifted writer. Nobody could write like him. Just fantastic, unquote. It is the rare athlete who takes an interest in those writing about them, but Crenshaw always did and continues to rattle off various authors or writers whose works that he loved or admired. Crenshaw recalled meeting Herbert Warren Wind for the first time when he played in a junior tournament at age 16. Wind is the writer who coined the phrase Amen Corner, the intersection of holes 11, 12, and 13 at Augusta National, in a 1958 Sports Illustrated story, the year that Arnold Palmer won the Masters for the first of four times. Where it all started for me when I was 16 years old, Crenshaw says, at the country club in Boston for the U.S. Junior Amateur. I met people that week I would play with for the rest of my life. I fell in love with the place, fell in love with the golf course, fell in love with the competition and golf history. I really enjoyed learning golf history, and I just felt I was so lucky to be able to play this place in Boston where Francis Ouimet won the 1913 U.S. Open as an amateur. I really had an affinity for that place. It stemmed from my appreciation for golf and appreciation for places and people, unquote. Crenshaw's chance meeting with Wind led to further dealings, including a time that the writer went to Texas to profile Harvey Penick, the golf instructor who worked with Crenshaw and fellow Austin golfer Tom Kite from their earliest days until the teacher's death on the eve of the 1995 Masters, which Crenshaw won 30 years ago, leading to his second Sports Illustrated cover. Penick, whose best-selling Little Red Book has sold more than 1 million copies and is still in circulation today, had a big influence on Crenshaw's career. And it is why Wynn's visit still resonates. He did a wonderful story on him, Crenshaw says. Apart from his writing at Sports Illustrated, he was writing for The New Yorker, and he would implore his editors to give him more space. He wrote such beautiful, lucid, long, meaty articles that were just filled with. It was the kind of writing that you had to have a thesaurus right next to you. To me, people like that gave me more appreciation of this game and its people, unquote. Crenshaw grew up at Austin Country Club and became friends and rivals with Kite, with whom he would attend the University of Texas. Crenshaw won three consecutive NCAA individual titles, sharing one of them with Kite, and won 9 other prestigious amateur titles. After turning professional, Crenshaw first had to make it through what today is called the PGA Tour qualifying tournament in order to have access to the weekly events. He won it by 13 shots. In his first event after winning Q School, Crenshaw won the Texas Open and its $25,000 first prize. The following week, he finished second at the 8-round World Open at Pinehurst, banking another $44,000. It was around this time that the cover story for Sports Illustrated began to take shape, although Crenshaw wasn't aware of it. In fact, he did not know it was happening until he saw the actual magazine with his face on the cover. "I cannot remember how this happened," he says. "All of a sudden, I saw me on this thing. Make way for the kid." Boy, that's a lot to say. I was feeling great and confident. "But it's a lot to put on you. I was just enjoying it, enjoying the competition, and enjoying playing tournament golf, seeing what I could do and have some success with it. I was a little surprised. People knew what kind of person I am. It was just fun to see people's reactions and how far I could stretch myself. I felt like I could accomplish a lot back then. When I would see the professionals, I remember longtime tour pro Dave Hill. He always gave me the business. 'You're going to come down hard someday.' I took a lot of kidding, which was great. I enjoyed playing with those guys. It was part of my golfing education. I just tried to soak up everything I could," unquote. By the time of the Sports Illustrated story, Crenshaw had already played in 6 major championships, having finished at low amateur at the 1972 and 1973 Masters. He was also the low amateur at the 1970 U.S. Open, his first major. Jenkins' story gushed that Crenshaw was golf's newest star. "Charm, charisma, appeal," he wrote. "Some golfers have hit it in like a Palmer or Lee Trevino, and others acquire it, as Jack Nicklaus and Ben Hogan did, by winning. Crenshaw undoubtedly has built it in, Palmer style, but he appears to be starting out with even more golfing ability than Palmer had," unquote. High praise, and then Crenshaw didn't win for 2 years. "I didn't quite think I lived up to Jenkins' words," Crenshaw says. "I was so young and just brand new. I was a kid," unquote. A jinx, perhaps? There were a cadre of people who subscribed to that theory, he says. "I had big highs and then lows, and had to climb out of it, just like a lot of golfers. Golf is a fickle game. When you have a good feel and you're confident, you feel like you can do something. If you get down and miss a couple of cuts in a row, you start searching. I would come back and see Harvey Penick. He could tell that I was listening to some people who would suggest things in my swing. And he would politely say, 'Just trust in your ability. You want to believe that.' He was right. You just realize that you're better off taking care of your own ability and working with that. Learning how to be patient. Learning how to score. Learning how to play courses better. That temptation to make shortcuts is lethal," unquote. Crenshaw's patience paid off. It took until January 1976 before he won again, capturing the Bing Crosby Pro-Am at Pebble Beach, the first of 3 victories that year. By 1984, he had won 9 times on the PGA Tour and had 5 runner-up finishes in majors, including a playoff loss to David Graham at the 1979 PGA Championship. In all, he had 16 top tens in the game's biggest tournaments, and the quote-unquote kid who had been on the Sports Illustrated cover a decade earlier was still without one of the biggest prizes. Quote, "History is filled with really capable players who never won a major, and I was close in many," Crenshaw says. You start wondering, and it gnaws on you, no question. You feel like you're capable, but you don't get it across. That's the mentality you're in. You really have to be patient somehow. It was such a relief to win that first Masters in 1984. It was humongous. I felt like I had it in me, but until you see it right in front of you, you've got to prove it," unquote. Crenshaw shot a final round 68 to finish 2 strokes ahead of Tom Watson and win his first major and 10th PGA title. And again, that feature is entitled Ben Crenshaw, Golf's Gentleman, Feels the Game's History Like No Other Champion, written by Sports Illustrated writer Bob Herrig. And that's all the time that we have for this reading of Sports Illustrated. My name is Bill, volunteer reader here at Sun Sounds of Arizona. Thanks for tuning in to this week's edition of Sports Illustrated. If you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org/broadcast info. And you could hear Sun Sounds on your smart home device.